everybody. I'm glad you guys all stuck around for the amphibians. It's nice to see you. Get it all bales and the fish are done. Thanks for humoring me a little bit. So who are we talking about? The Oregon spotted frog. He's the was listed state endangered in 97 and federally threatened in 2014. And as Marissa said, it's only listed aquatic species in the basin. Within the Chehalis Basin, it's in the Black River drainage only. A fully aquatic I'm sorry, guys. How's that? Any better? All right, fine. So fully aquatic, depending on that water for all of its life stages, it's very cryptic. We usually only find new sites through egg bass surveys. They lay a single unattached egg bass in super shallow water, and they have high site fidelity and communal oviposition. So by high site fidelity, I'm not talking about return to the same wetland. I'm talking about they will lay their eggs in a same 3-meter circle that they have returned to every year if that habitat's available. And communal position, hopefully you guys can see that picture on this. This is a nighttime picture taken. All of these little dots are egg masses. So, and then you can see all the frogs and all the eyeballs. This is hundreds of egg masses in this one location. So the similar species that you're probably all used to seeing is the red-legged frogs. That's the one you're going to stumble across when you're hiking out in the woods, walks in front of you on the trail. They have both the adults and juveniles spend a large amount of their time in the uplands. The eggs are laid on vegetation braids in deeper water. And physically, the differences between the two, some of them are the Oregon spotted frog has eyeballs that are more orientated upward for that aquatic lifestyle. Their eyes are orange or gold colored. And the red legged, you can see they're sticking more in the sides. And then the red leggeds also have very beautiful groin modeling. The spotted frogs are pretty bland. So, spotted frogs are fully aquatic, relying on the water for all their life stages, occupied palustrine wetlands connected to rivers and streams. That connectivity between their habitats is very important. The breeding sites are seasonally flooded marshes with shallow sun-exposed edges, similar to what you see in the picture here. Summer active season, perennial, typically greater than 4 hectares, and overwintering habitat that provides adequate dissolved oxygen and protection from freezing. The aquatic corridors between subpopulations for genetic exchange and dispersal are very, very important. According to the DFW recovery plan, the spotted frogs are not expected to recover without intervention, of which habitat management is an essential part. If we don't go out there and do something restoration-wise in their habitats, they will not be able to disappear from the landscape. They're highly susceptible to loss or alteration of wetland habitats and hydrological connections, alteration of creek and river channels that prevent the flooding of fields or increased draining speeds. Loss of disturbance processes that set back woody vegetation succession. Our non-natives, reed canary grass, bullfrogs, warm water fish, all problems for them. Like I said, isolation from other populations will increase the chances of local site loss and ever-doomed climate change. Historically, beaver and large browsers like deer and elk help to maintain some of the ecological processes, along with creek meandering, flooding, and periodic fires. So, just going to bounce through a couple pictures. That's some gorgeous habitat for spotted frogs. Woody vegetation succession, channelization, nice straight creek that drains. It's not normal. So within the Black River system, this map is about three years out of date, but it hasn't changed a whole lot. There's just a few more sites within these areas. Down here in the base of Miami Creek, Dempsey Creek, Salmon Creek, Allen, Beaver are the main tributaries. This is the population we'll spend most of the day talking about here. And you can see from this 2014 genetics, collected in 14, reported in 15, all of these populations have some relatedness. That's that importance that I was discussing about, not losing that connectivity between sites. So these guys need to have some way to get to these guys to exchange genetics. And even these guys here have some relationship to the populations way down here. So we're going to talk about West Rocky Prairie. This is the DFW-owned property. This area here is the headwaters of Allen Creek. It flows into Deep Lake, which is Miller, Sylvania, through Scott Lake, and then joins Beaver Creek down here. And then the other side of the West Rocky Prairie is the tributary headwaters of Beaver Creek, which flows down again, joins up with Allen there. This area right here, during high water in the winter, there is water exchange happening. So we have genetic exchange between our four known populations in the area. So here's the West and Central West, which are connected to Allen. Central East and East are Beaver. So during this high water season, these guys can get through, and we have exchange between all four locations. We also know that a frog that was caught here in the summer, a female, laid her eggs here that previous winter. So there's some large movement patterns that can happen between this area. So shallow water over position. This is kind of what you would have seen in that dark picture, if you can see what those eggs look like. I think there's probably about 40 or 50 egg masses there. You can see super shallow water. Here's us standing right in front of it. We're not talking large depths at all, and any kind of hydrological change that's rapid leaves eggs stranded very fast. In 2009 at West Rocky Prairie, we started a mowing experiment that all the yellow squares were mowed, west side and east side of those two populations. And we mowed this pattern for 2 years, mowed in the fall of 2009, again in 2010. This is what those plots look like. So here's a really nice, couple nice pictures of that's that reed canary grass without it being mowed. And this is providing now that nice open, shallow water habitat, full sun exposure. You see the wall there? It's a pretty drastic difference. So what do we see? So as far as the number of egg masses laid in those plots, the first 2 years that we did it, almost 100%. They liked that. They were really happy about us doing that. So as scientists and kind of jerks, we decided that we would flip those plots and see what would happen. Whoops. And yeah, they still liked it. They found a way to get over to those new spots. Few wanted to go to the old ones, but. And so we continued that pattern, slightly altering and moving the area that we mowed, but not flipping the plots anymore. We went back to the original pattern because that seemed to be what they liked a little bit better. And our goal wasn't to keep being jerks, but to provide better habitat for the species. So, through 2019, we've kept up a similar pattern of mowing again, like I said, just a slightly different, or slightly larger area. So what's that look like on the map? All the stars are the pre-2009s, and there's the yellows are everything since then. So what's the general takeaway? If you mow it, they're gonna come. we did learn that when we flipped those plots, we learned that there is nothing else between these two ditches that they really like. This spot here has the best habitat for them. So we just want to make sure that we always are doing this one. Over here on this side of the ditch, they have a little bit more area that supplies all the adequate parameters that they need. We don't understand all of those yet. We're learning, but not quite there yet. So how's that translated to egg masses? So this is our preseason data. We had 58 egg masses. The first 3 years after that, not a lot of change. Again, we were still mowing, same area, about the same as that first preseason year.
we just walked away in Scott County, we would assume there really wasn't anything besides this response of them liking to lay their eggs there, but no real change in the population. And then all of a sudden it was like, whoa, what happened? Our cows just skyrocketed off. It's like, ah, that's it, we solved it. There's something, we did something right, they're responding. Yay! And then this happened. And we are now lower than we were back where we started. Importance of a long-term data set? Huge. Again, we would have thought that we found the silver bullet. We have all the solutions, we know it's going to fix these guys. So, what do we know? Well, that 3-year increase may be related to our work. It's possible. It takes 3 years for a female OSF to reach adulthood. Substantial increase just happens to line up. This would have been the first year that they laid. 1, 2, 3. Well, maybe we did do something right. Maybe it's just the natural cyclic nature of this population. And because we don't have anything more than that, we got a couple data points way out here, 2001, 2010, and then we have a huge gap. So we don't know if this is something that just happens naturally with these guys. Are we active seasons habitat limited and they're highly susceptible to aquatic changes? We know the open position is. Well, guess what? 2015 drought right there. Is this what happened? It's possible. Harsh drought conditions of 2015 decreased the water levels of the 2 permanent summer ponds that are used for their summer refuge during that active season. That reduced the footprint overall active season habitat. It could have contributed to some adult and juvenile mortality, depressing the new adult breeding groups. Summer water levels in those ponds have fluctuated since 2015, but have not rebounded to pre-drought conditions. Further research needs to be done to understand this active season habitat. Could those decreases be related to overwintering habitats or something we don't know that's happening? What we do know is it's not the only population that saw similar declines. It seems to be a Black River watershed issue. Not necessarily just a West Rocky Prairie issue. So, we're going to talk about the East area a little bit. So all of that work was done up here in the West. The East area is the next. We did some level of restoration work here in these areas, but it's a little bit smaller scale, and I don't have as long-term data sets, but this area here is where we've really taken on a different tact. So we're not just hitting green canary grass, we're hitting woody vegetation over here. And 2018, so remember this was the original plots we had been mowing. So that's these funny squares. That's that old green canary grass we had been kept mowing for all these years. Well, we started whacking at this willow that was monopolizing this entire side here in this whole southern exposure area. So we've taken out between the two almost an acre and a half. In the last 2 years, and here's some pictures of what that looks like. So this is pre-waters coming in, and this was just this fall. So we got rid of all this root canary grass, walked away these willows, started opening up some habitat. These are old growth willows. We're not talking tiny little willow trees. That's a mini iPad. This has been here a while. This has been here and it's been expanding. This is a root system that's gone all the way through from one tree to another and many branches coming off. Here's a pile. This is a 6-foot guy. This is a large pile of mass. That picture on the right was right after those big rains we had a couple weeks ago. So we went from this to this. Now we got some nice shallow open habitat, lots of sun exposure. It's looking
pretty good. We got funded by the zoo to do a bunch of this willow work. So we just had to recycle. Had they came down and got a bunch of those willows, because it breaks my heart just to take things away. And so there's some pictures of some of the critters enjoying those willows. So we've done these big whack of the things. But also in addition to that, on the hydrology side, we've got to try to understand what's really happening out there. And in 2012, Northwest Land and Water put out a bunch of piezos and gauges and water entering wells and stuff, all associated with a gravel mining operation that was occurring on this adjacent property up here. And we want to make sure that that deep water gravel mine wasn't going to drain off this water system. So they needed to get a good baseline of what was happening, which has been fantastic for us, because it just happened that that's going to be able to feed into a lot of our data. So when I was talking about those ponds not recovering yet, here's 2014, previous was 2013 when the first real stage, there's that drought. So this is the groundwater one, here's the two ponds here. They have not gotten back to where they were in 2014 yet. Close, this one kind of came up and then dipped back down again. We're bouncing around, but it's just still not looking so great. This top graph up here just shows that that prime time place. This is in, I believe this was this gauge right here that's in one of the hot overposition areas or near it. So it kind of shows that tight band of water levels that we need to maintain in that thing, around that time frame. What are we seeing on the ground? That. That's bad. We're losing some active season water habitat. And we don't understand exactly what's happening outside of this drought. And maybe the water table has not gotten replenished yet to hold the water up there. So the hydrological monitoring, in addition to what he's already been doing, we're now funding some extra monitoring to do some, find out what our hydrological restoration potential is at this site. Before we go in and start slapping in a bunch of EDAs and digging ponds out, we want to understand what that's going to do to the environment in the area. We don't want to just do something because it sounds great. We need to understand what we have now and where we can put those things to work the best. So we're doing some total station elevation, ground surface water levels. We've already been collecting precipitation data, soil flows, life stage, habitat use data, and we're going to put those all into some climate change scenarios to hopefully see where we can put some beaver dam analogs, if that's the solution. You can put that into the thing. Is that going to work? Is that going to fix things? If it's not, then we need to move on. Pond creation, increase our summer habitat. If feasible, we know we have beaver loss. This used to be filled with beavers. Have I just lost a dam downstream? I don't have something holding this water back anymore. We'll be able to figure that out. So, and I mentioned this habitat use data. Huge hole that we just don't understand a lot of. We know from some preliminary work what these two summer ponds are that they a lot of frogs go to, but we've never caught all of our population. When we had 250 adult females laying eggs, we didn't catch 250 frogs. We've never seen that many frogs. So we need to understand where they're going. So we just installed some potato arrays. And on the west side, we've got six arrays in this channel, six in this channel. When the waters flood back, obviously the water comes up into these areas where they lay their eggs. We've got some really tiny pit tanks, so we can tag some really small juvenile frogs. And we're going to start trying to figure out some of these questions that we have. So where are the adults going pre- and post-breeding season? What is that summer habitat use? Where are they overwintering? What's our between season movements? How many frogs are moving out of this area? Remember we talked about that one female that made that huge trip around. Do we see that a lot? And adult versus juvenile wetland use. There's probably two different areas that the adults are staging and the juveniles are staging.
There may be some mixed in there, but and we're going to tag frogs that we capture in all four locations so we can see if there's movement between those frogs from the east side or coming to the west side at different times of the year. So here's the distances between those arrays roughly. This is this linear distance, the closest linear distance. We had no water in between here yet, so I knew the frogs had to be traveling through here thus far. We had 8 frogs from 2015 that we had tagged, just for the heck of it, because we were bored, I guess. we were forward thinking, that's it. And then this fall we went out and we caught 10 frogs. And so far we found some pretty cool stuff. It's only been operational since the end of October. So we have 2 frogs that we detected out of that 2015 batch. So those guys are at least 6 years old. That's pretty impressive. We've got one frog, one of those 2015 frogs that we picked up here. He made this whole journey in 22 hours. That's over a quarter mile, 1,500 feet roughly, for a little tiny frog in a short period of time. So he had a mission, he was going there. He has thus spent the rest of the time since, right here. We have a female that did this exact same journey, and it took her 9 days. She was out for a little stroll. And she senses dog back is kind of hanging out here around this number 6. We found that we have some frog staging. We tagged 8 frogs, and 5 of them are sitting right here. We've been getting periodic detections over the last 2 months. They might be bouncing between this area, but they seem to be keep coming back to the same spot. I don't pick them back up passing here or passing this one. Just happens to be that this is a large breeding area. Breeding starts in February. Just might be some connections there. Notice some activity temperatures. We have absolutely no movement of at least those 18 frogs when the temperatures are below 40 degrees. They seem to be pretty stationary. And nothing has happened, no detections during our extreme rain events. So they're hunkering down too. So what are our challenges? We got yearly regrowth of reed prairie grass. We're mowing it. It's not going away. It comes back every single year, just as high as it was before. We got yearly regrowth of our woody vegetation. Until we find a way to either paint it with some herbicides or rip those stumps out of the ground, that woody veg is going to keep coming back. Our small-scale efforts. You can do small-scale efforts on reed canary grass if it's early succession, and that seems to be pretty successful. There's been many people that have done. Where am I going? Many people that have done solar shade scraping, some choir maps with some burning and herbicide work, but it's small scale stuff. We've got to figure out a large scale solution. I've got a large area that we mow every single year, and it involves a couple weeks of prison crews or WCC guys just to keep that habitat in a overposition positive. So the most viable option right now is herbicides, but no herbicides are proven to be used in Oregon spider frog habitat. So if any of those species, it needs a little bit extra work. Lab testing of imazapyr suggests a low risk of direct toxic effects on juvenile OSS. Amy Yonke did a bunch of research on that, but it's not been tested on state-sensitive Olympic minnow, which co-occurs in most of the spider frog sites. Like most of you, herbicides isn't my favorite thing either. But we've been doing this for 10 years, and it's a lot of money, and it's not getting any better. And we have other problems that are happening, which we haven't even talked about. The reed canary grass rhizomes are starting to affect the local hydrology. We can see the changes happening. Inadequate knowledge of the seasonal habitat use and the changing hydrology can be detrimental to restoration success. Knowledge should be gained before actions are taken to minimize those negative outcomes. This is why before I go and drop those BDAs and those digging ponds out, we're trying to figure out what we really have on the landscape and what that looks like for the frogs. Continual beaver removal is hindering our natural hydrological processes. We have a lot of trapping. My guys have had trappers come by with beavers in the back of their trucks, ask where the best place to drop traps are. It's not helping us, and it's a challenge we'll keep fighting until we deal with a changing perspective on beaver. So here's just a couple of pictures that we canary brought us. This was March 2017, beautiful, gorgeous oviposition habitat we created here. This was that December. We had a communication breakdown in the get mode, so I didn't have any habitat for the following year. This is a flag, red flag, where the eggs have been laid the previous season, so that habitat disappears without taking care of it. And this is less than 2 months worth of regrowth on some of those old growth willows at the tail end of the growing season. You can imagine what that's gonna look like in the spring. So we're gonna have to keep going back and we had to deal with that situation. So that rhizome issue I was talking about, this is a chunk that I had to take out of here because I got egg masses were stranded for the first time ever, tadpoles were stranded for the first time ever, in fact, in this pool. Last year I needed to dig a trench right here to get them out to here. This is like 8 inches deep. And if you look at this picture, really, this used to be a nice flat sloping back to the wetland here. These are just hummock piles, and they're closing in, they're breaking up my water, causing problems. So if this water's a little higher when the frogs lay their eggs, and then it drops at all, they're getting isolated and stranded. So what are our key takeaways? They're not gonna recover if we don't help them. There's not much we can do. Biggest challenges, re-canary grass, woody vegetation succession, maintenance of the connections, climate change exacerbating things. We gotta look at this larger scale of re-canary grass removal. Maintenance of the opposition habitat is imperative, but it's not enough to solve all the problems. We've got to deal with the hydrology. Inadequate knowledge of the dynamics is detrimental, and they need the beavers. I didn't expect myself on such a large screen, so I'm not sure I'm gonna make it, but the frog's awful cute. Right next to his happy habitat there, so.